This is Radio Parallax, a slightly different perspective from a slightly different view, with topics that include matters in science, technology, history, politics, current events, and whatever we damn well please. And now the host of Radio Parallax, Douglas Everett.
Well, here we are, the election we've all been anticipating and fearful of, I dare say, is upon us. It takes place next week. Since we normally post these programs on Wednesday morning, that's going to create a bit of a problem for us on November 5th/6th. I suppose what Mr. Miller and I will do is wait till the polls close in California, which will be at 8 o'clock on Tuesday. By that time, there'll be a lot of information coming in from across the United States. I do not anticipate by any means that the election will be callable within a few hours of the polls closing in California. I mean, recall 2020. It took 3 days for us to know for sure Joe Biden was president. And of course, this time the Republicans have all sorts of mischief up their sleeves ready to pull out on Election Day. And anyway, that's next week's problem. This week's problem is we're going to summarize all of what we said over the past many weeks and months about election 2024 in conjunction with a couple recent developments. We will deal with some of those by using some clips in our second segment today that talked about what has just happened at Madison Square Garden and other locations. And before I get too deeply into this, I should mention, based on the request of a reader, for any information about the California ballot propositions. And no, we're not going to get into any of that, but I can recommend to Nikki and the rest of you that the summary done on Channel 8 in San Diego, done about on the 17th or so of October, goes into the 10 ballot propositions and does a fine job. Check it out if you're so inclined, and I'm sure quite a few of you are. I guess we'll start with today is the issue of sane washing. It seems to be a fact that the mainstream media takes these incredibly crazy things that Trump says and translates them into conventional English. Let us again take a look back at some quotes we had on the show a few weeks back, starting with Parker Malloy writing in the New Republic, saying that as an unhinged Donald Trump vies for a second White House term, the press is failing America. Faced with an incoherent candidate who has blamed wind power for the high price of bacon and insists that Latin American countries are sending legions of Hannibal Lecters across the border, the media routinely engages in sane washing, laundering Trump's insane rants to make him sound far more coherent than he actually is. They're failing to adequately convey the threat of a candidate who's vowing to wage a bloody campaign to deport millions of illegal migrants and impose long-term prison sentences on Democratic lawyers and election officials who work to ensure voting integrity. Now, it's pretty clear the media is afraid of being accused of bias, but really, at this point, that's really not a good excuse. It also seems to be a subplot of what's going on that a lot of the media moguls are looking around and thinking, you know, he might win this thing, so let's play ball. Jeff Bezos, the owner of Amazon and also the Washington Post, decided to tell his editorial staff that, you know, this time we're not going to make a recommendation for president. This caused his editor to walk out the door in a huff, and apparently the Washington Post has lost 200,000 subscribers in the last week. And come to them, when I get around to it, I think I'll be one of them too. The billionaire owner of the LA Times decided that, well, you know what, we're not going to make an endorsement either. More on that to follow. But I think the editorial page from the Week magazine, the current edition of the Week, is something I need to quote from directly. Said editor-in-chief, Theunis Bates, "If Donald Trump wins on November 5th, it will be partly because the traditional press failed to present the former president as he truly is. That's the argument put forward by the many media critics who accuse the New York Times, CNN, Washington Post, and other legacy outlets of sane washing Trump, selectively quoting or editing his rambling, threat-filled, and profanity-laced rally speeches. This habit seems to stem from mainstream news outlets wanting to appear, quote, objective, a quote. If they did accurately cover Trump's extremism and bizarre behavior, it would look like they were in the tank for Democrats. As a result, Trump's repeated pledges to round up and deport millions of undocumented immigrants, whom he's called, quote, animals, unquote, and, quote, not human, unquote, gets labeled by the Times as hyperbolic rhetoric rather than 100-proof authoritarianism. In his weird disquisitions about whether it's better to be eaten by a shark or die from electrocution, for example, go unmentioned in many reports on campaign events, which instead focus on sane-sounding policy announcements such as eliminating taxes on tips. These are valid criticisms, notes the editor-in-chief, but they vastly overplay the ability of mainstream media to shape the national conversation. Newspapers and network news have shrinking audiences, while social media is grabbing ever more eyeballs. About 50% of Americans now go to platforms like TikTok, X, and Instagram to get their news, where they also get a flood of disinformation served up by influencers, hucksters, and propagandists. A Russian-created fake video smearing Democratic Vice President nominee Tim Walz with abuse allegations has been viewed some 5 million times on X. Millions more have seen bogus AI-generated images of Trump wading through the floodwaters in the wake of Hurricane Helene, feeding a Trump-backed narrative that only he and not the Biden administration cares about the storm's victims. Clearly, we have a reality problem, but it's one the traditional media is largely powerless to fix. And I have to say, we do wonder about that. We've been talking ourselves a blue streak on this program about things that we think need to be before the public. And some outlets have been doing a pretty good job. MSNBC has been doing a good job. CNN, maybe not so much. We reported a year ago about how CNN was going to move to the center, they said. And of course, anybody who watched the Biden-Trump debate where Trump was not fact-checked would have to agree that they didn't do such a hot job. And of course, when ABC put on the debate between Harris and Trump was openly fact-checked for some of the outrageously bogus statements he made, the Republicans were in quite a huff over the whole idea. Who are they to question the president? And to that, I would answer, people who are doing what they're supposed to do. So, the sane-washing issue is real. The media falling down on the job is also real. Of course, if nobody's watching ABC, CBS, ABC, or reading the Washington Post or New York Times or LA Times, and instead getting their news from TikTok and Instagram, well, we do have a problem. And we've talked about in this program over the last few years on many occasions the fact that once people build a bubble around themselves and they are getting their news by things they have pre-selected, acted as their own gatekeeper for what will get in and get out, well, you're going to have some biases reinforced. It just comes with the territory. And I think it's rather criminal that the same big tech corporations, social media corporations that are making this a reality are also now deciding that they may want to hedge their bets and jump on the Trump train. Elon Musk coming to mind at the top of the list. And we all know that at this point, this election comes down to 7 swing states. Hard to believe that Trump is going to carry something like 26 states. I mean, that's just a given, and that's frightening. But it is a fact that the Electoral College magnifies the power of small rural states manyfold over the power of voters in states like California and New York. And when I talk about this, I think about a friend of mine who told me many years ago, was very frank about how it was when she would have long animated conversations about this, that, and the other. She would look at me and say, well, I tell you what you want to hear, which I do with everybody. That makes people very receptive to the message I'm putting out. Of course, the sad part about that is what Trump decided the people wanted to hear, which he then told them. Fact is, Trump is not a very smart guy. I mean, a smart guy would not go bankrupt 6 times. Once or twice, maybe. But 6 times? You have to be a very, very bad businessman to do that. We also know from his tax records that for a 10-year period in the 90s, he apparently lost more money than anyone else in the United States of America. That's not, ladies and gentlemen, a good businessman. One of the most interesting subplots about all the people that are lining up to join a Trump administration is that I think they all realize that the key to success is to kiss his butt, tell him he's a genius, and then you've won him over. He'll let you do what it is you want to do. I think that the foreign leaders like Vladimir Putin, Xi Jinping, Benjamin Netanyahu, they would really like to see Trump in the White House because they know how pitifully easy it is to manipulate him. This is something that has come up from his aides again and again and again. So a sad fact to note, in spite of our efforts here in Radio Parallax to get out what we think is a good approximation of the truth, because we accept that perhaps there is no such thing truly as the truth, but it's a matter of degrees. Remember back in school when you had to do calculations using pi as one of the terms? Well, what is pi? If you say 3.1416, you're pretty close. If you say 3.14159265535, you're closer. I once asked a NASA scientist how many places out they needed to take pi to get accurate calculations on the trajectories of spacecraft, and he said 16 places. So I think you get the point. You can get various degrees of accuracy in looking at what the truth is. Writing in The Atlantic a couple years ago, Megan Garber, looking at the Trump phenomenon, said in her essay, "The truth won't matter." She started as follows. "I have a gut," Donald Trump announced in 2018, "and my gut tells me sometimes more than anybody else's brain can ever tell me." The author said the president's gut would go on to inform him that climate change is partisan propaganda, that COVID-19 might be cured through the injection of bleach, and that any election that fails to produce a Trump victory must be rigged. And yes, ladies and gentlemen, it does appear that an awful lot of people have outsourced their mind to Trump's gut. The author notes sarcastically, "You'd be foolish not to. Science lies to you. Hollywood lies to you. The media lies to you. Books lie to you. Courts lie to you. Teachers lie to you. Other people lie to you. Democracy lies to you. The only thing you can trust in this dizzying world is the inveterate liar who would never lie to you." Still, there's a lot going on here in this election. It isn't just a matter of Donald Trump. The Republican Party and its wealthy donors have been moving America to the right successfully for many decades now. And I think this is worth mentioning. I have an article here by David Korn, which appeared in Mother Jones in October of 2022, which said, "We have some bad news for those who wish that today's unhinged Republican Party would just return to normal." The article goes on to explain how it was in the 1950s that Joe McCarthy made communism a glue to wield together a lot of right-wing forces in the country. In 1964, Barry Goldwater managed to secure the Republican nomination for president, and in a pratfall of a campaign, lost decisively to Lyndon Baines Johnson. But make no mistake about it, today's conservatives date back to that 64 Republican conservative campaign. Nixon decided in the 1960s that the Southern strategy was the key to Republican success, electoral success down the road. He wanted to reach out to those Southern Democrats who were not too fond of civil rights. These were the George Wallace voters. People forget that in 1968, George Wallace ran on a segregationist platform and carried five Southern states, the last non-Republican or Democrat to do so. Then in the Reagan Bush 41 era, the Republican Party worked out a deal with Christian fundamentalists. And boy, oh boy, they haven't gone away. The right-wing elements in this country chose Donald Trump. But if you could recall back to 2016 and the people that were running against Trump, the alternatives weren't so great. I remember pulling for Donald Trump when, in the Republican debate, he turned to Jeb Bush and said, "Yeah, well, your brother got us in a war in Iraq, which was a big, fat mistake." I thought at the time that the value of Donald Trump would be to run and lose in 2016 and in the process derail the possibility of Jeb Bush becoming a third Bush president. Well, that didn't work out. Writing in the Philadelphia Inquirer last year, Will Bunch said our democracy's downward spiral could accelerate, and that would delight a small but influential gaggle of far-right thought leaders, supposed intellectuals at Hillsdale College and the Claremont Institute, to which I would add, or possibly the Heritage Institute. See the spreading rot as proof of the need for a red Caesar, an authoritarian who will suspend democracy, root out the liberal deep state, and impose order. That a growing number of conservative academics and billionaire donors are embracing an explicit plea for dictatorship is deeply alarming. Noting, he added, especially because we all know who the actual red Caesar is, even if he is technically orange. Writing in the LA Times last year, Doyle McManus said, if you think that's hyperbole, you're not paying attention. Trump has laid out a terrifying authoritative vision for a second term. We'll get into that in our second segment today and some of the details of what has been said of late. Although it is worth mentioning that earlier this year, in March, Trump said that if he's not elected, there's going to be a bloodbath in the country. That got some people's attention. Writing in Substack, Timothy Snyder, an expert on authoritarianism, said, let's look at the real context of the bloodbath warning. Trump's rally started with a brazen celebration of the convicted criminals who beat cops and used an actual bloodbath to try and reverse the election results. Trump's pledge to pardon them was a clear signal that if he regains power, he'll protect anyone who commits violence on his behalf. His opponent, Trump said, is allied with subhuman, quote, animals, unquote, who will destroy America. History tells us this is all straight from the fascist playbook. Those who ignore Trump's core message are the ones taking Trump's remarks out of context. And yes, there you have it. On this program, for many years, we've been comparing what the Republicans have been up to fascism. And I think I've even said more than once, it isn't the Republican Party anymore in America. It's the American Fascist Party. Back in 2003, we quoted extensively from a wonderful piece by Lawrence Britt about 14 things that fascist regimes have in common. And sadly, 21 years later, it's worth going over some of those yet again. But the F word has gotten out of the bag. People are now openly talking about whether Trump is running as a fascist. It's gone from the woolly hinterlands of the likes of Radio Parallax to the mainstream media. And frankly, it's about time. Steve Bannon, writing in MSNBC, said that for 9 disturbing years of Donald Trump's political career, his opponents have for the most part avoided publicly referring to the Republican Party as fascist. But last week, everything changed. First, news broke that retired General Mark Milley, Trump's hand-picked chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, had called the former president a total fascist and fascist to the core. That was in interviews with veteran reporter Bob Woodward. Within days, former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and former House GOP Conference Chair Liz Cheney had seconded Milley's remarks. Finally, Vice President Kamala Harris, asked by radio host Charlemagne the God, and I don't know who that is, but anyway, she was asked by him if fascism fairly characterizes Trump's vision of the country. She replied, yes, we can say that. Sasha Abramski, writer for The Nation, and I believe a Radio Parallax guest at one time, said that Milley may have handed the Democrats a permission slip for using the F word, but Trump's own rhetoric has become dramatically darker in recent weeks. He has threatened to jail election officials, revoke the licenses of less than fawning TV networks, and unleash the military on Democratic opponents, which he calls the enemy within. Democrats should have done it months ago, but the belated decision to call a fascist is very welcome. Weighing in on this in the New York Times, Michael S. Schmidt said, John Kelly is no progressive. The retired 4-star general was Trump's longest-serving chief of staff. This week, the fiercely private Kelly went on record to state that Trump told him more than once that Adolf Hitler, quote, did some good things, unquote, and that he wanted, quote, his generals to be like Hitler's, loyal to him, that is, and not the U.S. Constitution. In his own view, Kelly said, Trump certainly falls into the general definition of fascist. Writing in The Atlantic, Ann Applebaum said, Trump barely tries to hide it. When he talks about immigrants, quote, poisoning the blood of America, or calls his political opponents vermin, Trump is intentionally echoing Hitler and Benito Mussolini. This fascist rhetoric has a specific purpose. If you dehumanize your foes, then you can much more easily arrest them, deprive them of rights, exclude them, or even kill them. And you know, we may not have time on today's program to go over something I mentioned last week, which was that the whistleblower who first brought the matter of Trump's call to Zelensky to some of the appropriate authorities, well, that whistleblower feared for his life. And I have to say, in my own personal opinion, I imagine with good cause. Also writing the New York Times, James Bowie said that the mystery is that we're not more alarmed. Trump is closing his campaign with an explicit promise to govern as an autocrat. An administration this time purged of the Milley and Kelly-like figures who resisted Trump's tyrannical impulses to seize the voting machines and unleash the military on Black Lives Matter protesters. Yet, many of us are still sailing toward November 5th as if this were an ordinary election with ordinary stakes. Writing in The Bulwark, Will Salatin said, "There's no mystery. We like to think that fascism can't happen in America, so we simply choose not to believe what Trump is telling and showing us every day, which is that it's happening right now." So let's go back to July 6, 2003, clipping, which I took out of the Sacramento Bee, piece by Lawrence W. Britt, titled 14 Things That Fascist Regimes Have in Common. Well, let's go through a couple of them, most of them. You can make the call, dear listener, whether you think this applies to Trump, the MAGA people, and the GOP. The study was based on a look at Nazi Germany, Fascist Italy, Franco's Spain, Salazar's Portugal, Papadopoulos's Greece, Pinochet's Chile, and Suharto's Indonesia, which does constitute a mixed bag of national identities, cultures, development levels, and history. But, said Lawrence Britt, they all follow the fascist model in obtaining, expanding, and maintaining power. Further, all those regimes have been overthrown, so a more or less complete picture of their basic characteristics and abuses is now possible. So here are the 14 common threads which emerge from a look at these seven different fascist regimes. Number one, they demonstrate powerful and continuing expressions of nationalism, from the prominent displays of flags and bunting to the ubiquitous lapel pins. The fervor to show patriotic nationalism, both on the part of the regime itself and of citizens caught up in its frenzy, was always obvious. And as a corollary to that, it was usually coupled with a suspicion of things foreign, often bordering on outright xenophobia. So how do you think that applies to a candidate that refers to Mexicans as rapists? Second aspect of fascist regimes, there's a disdain for the importance of human rights. Now, while it's true that Donald Trump did not actually engage the military to shoot political protesters, he asked why they couldn't. Shoot him in the leg, I think, was his solution. No, not necessarily shoot them fatally, but just wound them, wing them. Trait number three, identification of enemies / scapegoats as a unifying cause. Scapegoating was used as a means to divert the people's attention from other problems and to shift blame for failures and to channel frustration in controlled directions. How do you think that stacks up against a candidate that wants to deport all illegal aliens in the country? By the way, if they ever get around to implementing that plan, they're going to need more housing space than we have in all of America's prisons at present. Fourth trait of a fascist regime is the supremacy of the military and avid militarism. They note that a disproportionate share of national resources was allocated to the military, even when domestic needs were acute. I think this is accurate, but I don't think in this particular instance we can point the finger at the Republicans or Trump more than just the reality of the Pentagon getting a very big slice of the budgetary pie year in and year out. Item number five, rampant sexism. These regimes invariably viewed women as second-class citizens. Well, and of course, we just got rid of Roe v. Wade, courtesy of the three Trump Supreme Court appointees. And there are those on the right who are pushing for a ban of abortion nationwide, an elimination of the ability to use pharmaceutical agents to induce abortion, and in some instances, to ban contraception, period. And while we're at it, no-fault divorce. It goes without saying that IVF has to go. Are these the thoughts of conservative politicians in America or the Catholic Church College of Cardinals? And of course, the sixth trait under these fascist regimes was that there was control of the mass media. The methods included the control of licensing and access to resources, economic pressure, appeals to patriotism, and good old implied threats. The author notes that the leaders of the mass media were often politically compatible with the power elite. And the result was usually success in keeping the general public unaware of the regime's excesses. Number seven was an obsession with national security. And that one, I think, again, is just a factor of American life. I don't think I can point to the Republicans or Trump as fascist in that regard. Number eight was religion and the ruling elite being tied together. And looking at the Republican Party, I don't think I need to belabor that one now, do I? Number nine and 10 were respectively power of the corporations protected and the power of labor suppressed or eliminated. And I think in contemporary America, we've seen both of those things happening, but it's not all the Republicans to be blamed for that, in my opinion. Got four to go. Number 11 was disdain and suppression of intellectuals and the arts. This was interesting because something like 50 years ago, the idea of conservative intellectuals was considered by some to be an oxymoron. The Republicans have built up various think tanks since then to put a veneer of intellectualism on a lot of their, well, sometimes crackpot ideas. And thus we have Project 2025, which Trump is trying to disavow, which comes to us courtesy of the Heritage Foundation. More on that later. Number 12 was obsession with crime and punishment. What's worrisome here is that normal and political crime were often merged into trumped-up criminal charges and sometimes used against political opponents of the regime. 13 was rampant cronyism and corruption, noting that those in business circles and close to the power elite often use their positions to enrich themselves. Again, I think that's something that's somewhat bipartisan, although I would say the Republicans are a lot better at it. And the last item of a fascist regime, which they all have in common, were fraudulent elections. We started doing radio, Mr. Millen and I, back in the year 2000, at which point the Bush versus Gore campaign was underway. And I think it's fair to say that, well, that one had fraudulent results in the end. And 4 years later, we revisited that topic in the Kerry versus Bush race. And we concluded, although it seemed to have been missed by the mainstream media, that, well, that one didn't pass the smell test either. And of course, we're going to get a real education in efforts to create a fraudulent election in just a few days. We'll have to see how this goes. And as we go to a break, which we need to do shortly, I started to realize that I'm going to go out with a quote from Joseph Goebbels, the Minister of Propaganda of the Nazi Party of Germany. Goebbels said there was no point in seeking to convert the intellectuals, for intellectuals would never be converted and would anyway always yield to the stronger. And this will always be the man in the street. Arguments must therefore be crude, clear, and forcible, and appeal to emotions and instincts, not the intellect. Truth was unimportant and entirely subordinate to tactics and psychology. I guess I got to say in closing that if Trump's gut does have one thing that leads him in the right direction on it, it's how to play on people's emotions and psychology. Because it's pretty clear he certainly falls down in the facts department. Let's take a short break. You're listening to Radio Parallax. I'm Douglas Everett.